It is my distinct pleasure to be here. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speak to you, grateful for the invitation, and grateful for the presence of each of you who've come out this afternoon. This is nap time when I go to lectureships, and we appreciate your coming today. I walked out in the hallway after the last lecture to accost Gene West about calling my mother a bad person because she was a school teacher. And the first thing he said to me was, "I want to know how you became an authority on being a godly wife." Well, I wondered the same thing myself when I received the assignment. I saw Eddie Cooper was down for godly husbands. That was good. Denver Cooper was down for godly grandparents. And that was good. And here I was given the subject of godly wives. Then it dawned on me that the director of the School of Preaching here works every day with my mother. After she's retired school, she's the librarian here. And he knows her now and knows what she was as a wife. And then it dawned on me that the director of our School of Preaching here had a daughter who went to a High Valley College with me, and from the stories that she told him, he must have reasoned that anyone who would marry me would either have to be stupid or godly. And knowing that Marcia, my dear wife, was not the former, figured that she must be the latter, and so assigned me this topic. She didn't write this lecture. As a matter of fact, I didn't let her see it, and I wouldn't let her come to hear it. And that's because I like my wife. I like my marriage. And we want them all to stay intact. She really did want to come today. Her mother and stepfather drove in from Missouri for these lectures, but some setbacks have come because of children's illnesses. You know how that is. They may be able to be here tomorrow. It's hard to go on from right here, because when I look out here, usually when you preach, you see someone you can preach to. But I don't see anyone I can preach to today. I look out and I see people that I could point at and name. Most of you ladies who are very godly, and if your wives are godly wives. Nevertheless, we hope this lesson can be some sort of review for us all in our thinking. That's generally the way lectureships go, is that we review our thinking and refresh ourselves so that we might be able to go out and teach others. Realizing that the older women have the responsibility, from Titus chapter 2, to teach the younger women, we hope these things can be of some encouragement today. I could talk about each one of these ladies. I could talk about my mother or my wife or a number of other people in the audience today and the godliness that they show in their lives, but that's really not my purpose, and they wouldn't want me doing that. My purpose is to go to the Bible and try to find out what's expected of a godly wife, and then determine how a wife being godly can actually solidify the home. And Eddie did a fine job of defining for us what we mean by solidify the home, as I'm sure has been done earlier in the week as well, so we won't spend much time there. Suffice it to say that it's a given, I think, that each person in their lives, whatever roles they have, whatever roles they experience, have an influence on other people. The old saying that, you know, I'll live my life as I want to and leave me alone is just hollow. It's untrue. It's false. Rather, the true statement that better epitomizes the way we affect other people is Romans 14:7. For none of us lives to himself and none of us dies to himself. We have an effect on other people. And godly wives will have an effect on people for godliness. Wives who neglect godliness will have an effect on people neglecting godliness. And those who just utterly turn and rebel against godly ways will have an effect on people that way as well, as will men. I get to be the male chauvinist of the week since I get this topic. It'll sound like I'm picking on wives, but that's just because it's within the scope of the lecture. First of all, we probably ought to notice godliness general principles that apply to everybody. Godliness is something to be pursued. It's something to be sought after. 1 Timothy 6:11, Paul encourages Timothy to flee certain things, but pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, and gentleness. These are things to be pursued. Now, when you pursue something, you are going after it as if you really wanted to catch it. It's not like when I'm pursuing my little one-and-a-half-year-old son around the house saying, "I'm going to get you." I don't really want to catch him. I want him to feel like he won. When you're pursuing something, you really want to catch it, and when you're pursuing godliness, you want to be like God. More than anything, you hunger and thirst for righteousness. The good thing about that is that Jesus promises that if you hunger and thirst for that, you'll be filled. Godliness is something that has to be exercised toward. 1 Timothy 4, verses 7 and 8, exercise yourself toward godliness, for bodily exercise profits a little, but godliness is profitable unto all things, having promise of the life which now is and of the life which is to come. Bodily exercise only gives us promise of the life that now is, and if that should be taken away from us in a moment by an accident, an injury, or in a brief period of time by an illness, the bodily exercise and its good has gone away. But if we exercise ourselves towards godliness, giving all diligence to add to our faith, virtue to virtue, knowledge to knowledge, self-control to self-control, perseverance and to perseverance, godliness, then someday we'll be rewarded for it. And after our bodies are done on this earth, it'll still have done some good. Godliness is walking worthy of the calling that God has given us. You know, no words, there's a lot of words in the Bible that scares me. I think it was Mark Twain that said, it's not the words in the Bible that I don't understand that frighten me, it's the words that I do understand that frighten me. There, one passage that at least gives me a sense of awe about my responsibility as a Christian is Ephesians 4, verse 1, where Paul beseeches the brethren to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called. Now, if you read the first three chapters of Ephesians, you know he's talking about no small, insignificant calling. He is talking about the very fact that he planned from before the foundation of the world to redeem us to him after we separated ourselves from him in sin by sending his only son to die for us, to take the penalty for our wickedness. And we're supposed to walk worthy of that calling if we want to be godly. Being godly, then, demands a total reliance on God's instructions. 2 Peter 1 and verse 3, he's given us all things that pertain to life and godliness, and so we go here in what he's given us in this revelation for those instructions. Specifically, for ladies, there are a couple of passages of Scripture that tell us that the godliness that they are supposed to exemplify is not something that is only inward, but also shows itself outwardly. Did you know that? 1 Timothy 2, verses 9 and 10, the Apostle Paul says, in like manner also, that the women adorn themselves with modest apparel, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or fine clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness. A lot of people in our world today, you know, they say, what I wear has nothing to do with who I am inside. Well, Paul says it does. And how women attire themselves has something to do with whether or not they're the kind of person God wants them to be. And then 1 Peter 3, verses 3 and 4, a passage that we'll be referring back to more later, says, do not let your adornment be merely outward, as he speaks to wives. Do not let your adornment be merely outward. About every chance I get to speak to young people, I try to throw in a comment that degrades the idea that their self-worth is based upon how they look. Because our culture gives them that idea, you realize. We get the idea that it's how we look and how rich we are that determine whether or not we're worth anything. And a young lady grows up, and if she doesn't look like the supermodels that so shamelessly reveal themselves in our publications, she feels like she's not worthy of a good husband, or she's not worthy of even a good life. But you see, bodily exercise profits a little, but godliness is profitable to all things. And those young ladies and these old ladies and these young men and these old men are worth everything because they're created in God's image, no matter what they look like. So Peter says, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. A lady who works on her heart more than she does her makeup is who the young fellows ought to be searching out for as wives. They told us in a preacher class that I had at Harding to be careful about who we married because our wives would either make us or break us. I don't think they meant financially, although that might apply on the break part. But you know what they meant, and I found it to be true. And I was fortunate enough to find someone who's helping make me anything that I am. Godliness is something that ought to be sought for in wives and ought to be pursued by wives. But what is that godliness? What exactly does it demand? What does it entail? We know that if a person wants to go to heaven, well, they've got to believe the gospel, repent of their sins, confess Christ as the Son of God, be baptized for the remission of their sins, and then live a godly life. But that godly life entails so much, and it gets right down to every role in which we could possibly function. Allow me to refer back to the book of Ephesians again. The first three chapters tell us all about what God's done for us. The last three chapters tell us all about what we got to do because what God has done for us. I know that's not good grammar, but I wanted to say it that way. We've got to do these things in our relationships because of what God has done for us. We've got to try to keep unity in the church. We've got to try to live a life different from the heathens that are still out there. We've got to treat our wives right. Wives have to treat their husbands right. Parents have to treat their children right, and children have to treat their parents right. Employers, masters, have to treat their employees right, and employees have to treat their employers right. There are instructions for our roles in the Bible. What are the instructions then for a godly wife? What are the specific instructions of godliness for wives? First, there's the principle of commitment. Eddie referred to Matthew 19 in his lesson, and I'll refer there too, just to prove to him I know the passage too. But in Matthew 19, Jesus was encountered by some Pharisees who were trying to test him, and they asked him about divorce. Apparently, they wanted a reason to divorce, and in the law of Moses, the people had become so hardened of heart that God just allowed them to divorce and remarry some. But Jesus' answer, of course, to them is, from the beginning it was not so. God made them male and female. He wanted them to leave father and mother and cleave to each other. He wanted them to be together for life unless there's unfaithfulness on the part of one spouse. And then he mercifully granted that exception. That commitment governs a lot of areas. Do you realize that? It governs a lot of aspects of a Christian's life who decides to be married. First of all, it governs relations to parents. Eddie referred to this briefly as well. There's got to be a leaving and a cleaving. I try to put this in all of the wedding ceremonies that I do, at least both of them so far. There's got to be a leaving and a cleaving. You've got to leave the parents and cleave. I know I could name you marriages that have broken up because one spouse did not leave their parents far enough behind. I could probably name you more of those marriages than the ones I've done, as sad as it is. But there was one marriage where a lady listened to her mother a great deal, and she got engrossed in some of the afternoon soap operas and became infatuated with one of the characters, wondered why her husband wouldn't treat her like that when he was treating her really pretty well, but wondered why her husband wouldn't be as romantic as that. Her mother contributed to that idea, and it finally ended the marriage. I forget who told me this story, but it was about an old man who, well, he wasn't so old, but his daughter had just got married, moved into her new home with her husband across town. One night they had a fight, and the daughter showed up at her parents' door and said, "Can I please stay here tonight? We just had our horrible fight, and I'm just as upset as can be." The father said, "No, you can't stay here. This isn't your home anymore. Go home and work it out with your husband." I suppose in that situation, it's the best thing he could have done. When a couple says "I do" to each other, they must realize that they are committing themselves to each other to work through anything that comes up and to leave behind other influence. This doesn't mean you don't go to parents asking for advice. It certainly doesn't mean you don't go to them asking for a little money now and then. As long as they don't want, you know, buy some influence. A second area of commitment that's obvious, that probably doesn't need, well, I'm pretty sure it doesn't need preached too much here today, but it needs preached a lot in the younger generation, is that area of commitment in physical relations. Paul said in Ephesians 2 that the Gentiles, and he said all of us at one time, walked just to fulfill the lust of our flesh, fulfill the desires of our flesh and of our minds. We just walked according to the course of the world. Well, the course of today's world, let me tell you, is not faithfulness to your spouse. Paul also said in 1 Corinthians 6 that there are foods for the stomach and the stomach for foods, but God will destroy both it and them. His point was, the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord. God made our bodies, and he made us in such a way that we would have these kinds of sexual desires. But he also gave us an area in which we should have those kinds of sexual desires fulfilled to protect us from the harm that can come when we go outside of that. The definition of any lust, I think, is some kind of natural desire that we have taken outside of its intended context. While we get hungry, so that we'll remember to eat and be strong enough to go about our daily tasks. But you know as well as I do that when that hunger gives way to gluttony, then it becomes an ungodly lust. We have those desires, and it's not exactly like hunger, of course, because total abstinence is possible from fulfilling these kinds of desires I'm talking about. But if abstinence is not chosen, there is an arena in which those are allowed and an arena in which they're not. When wives or husbands commit fornication, they sin against God, Genesis 39:9. They sin against themselves, 1 Corinthians 6:18. And they sin against their partner. It's one of the few sins I know of where you actually cause someone else to sin at the same time. What probably ought to be preached a lot in the church is not this, I should back up and say this should be preached as well. But we ought to go a step further back and warn people with the words of Jesus in Matthew 5:27-28. You know it's wrong to commit adultery, I'm paraphrasing, but I tell you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, I'm not a prophet, and I'm not a foreteller of the future, but from what little bit of experience I've had where I've seen marriages break up because of unfaithfulness, and then I look at some other marriages that are still going on, but they're in trouble, you think there could be trouble with unfaithfulness down the line here. Why? Because these people are filling their minds with things that encourage that sort of thing. And as soon as the mind is filled with those sort of things, the very next step that the body wants to take is action. You've seen it. You've read it. It's very natural to act on all of that. In marriage, however, these relations are just as pure and holy as anything else that God created. Marriage is honorable in all and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. As a matter of fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, the Apostle Paul commands that the wife render due affection to her husband and the husband render due affection to his wife. Neither one of them has control over themselves. Neither one of them has complete control over the other. They each have control of each other in these relations. And they are not to deprive one another except with consent for a time, that they may give themselves to fasting and prayer, and then come together again so that Satan won't tempt you because of your lack of self-control. It's hard in a world where guys go to work with ladies who are all very nicely dressed when they get there. And when they've left home in the morning, and you know what they saw when they left home. One story is about a lady who, her husband, you know, forgot to take out the trash, because that is the man's job. Her husband forgot to take out the trash, and so she was running out late as the garbage truck was about to leave, carrying the garbage bag with her rollers in her hair and her bathrobe on and no makeup on her face yet. And she's carrying this bag of trash and says, "Hey, trash man, is it too late? Is it too late?" And he said, "No, lady, hop on." I think as husbands and wives, we ought to take care of ourselves for one another. Husbands should not let that be a temptation to them. Don't get me wrong. When they go to the workplace and see ladies who are always dressed up and compare that to what they see at home, that's an invalid comparison. But some couples need to learn that they need to keep themselves clean for each other, need to keep themselves desirable to each other. One young lady that we know, when she was married on her wedding day, her father took her with her full bridal gown on, stood her in front of a mirror and said, "You see that young lady in there?" You know, on her wedding day, she didn't have time for this. "Yeah, what's he doing?" And he said, "Your groom is marrying a very beautiful young lady today. You keep yourself that way for it." Now, lest you think that I'm contradicting what I said earlier, that beauty does not determine the worth of a person, I'm not saying that she ought to be beautiful, that she ought to have the world's standards of beauty. And I'm not saying that the husband ought to have the world's standards of handsomeness. But doesn't it make sense from Paul's instructions in 1 Corinthians 7 that if they're not going to deprive one another, they ought to want to do their best for each other to keep themselves as desirable as possible? Food for thought. Secondly, the godliness of a wife is determined by whether or not she is fulfilling her role of submission, as she should. We should point out the obligatory comments here that submission is not inferiority, because Jesus was equal to God, but he submitted to God while he was on this earth. I'm equal to some of the people that I elect in office, really to all the people that I elect in office or don't elect into office, but I have to submit to them. And so when God says through the Apostle Paul in Ephesians 5 that wives should submit to their husbands, he is not saying take an inferior position. He's just saying that there can't be two leaders in the home. And for some reason, well, the reason he gave us is that man was created first and woman sinned first. At least for the roles in the church, that's the reason he gave us. But the reason has nothing to do with it. God said the man would be the head of the house and the woman would be in submission. Neither is the principle of submission popular. And it's become unpopular in our world because of its abuse by so many people. I know of another couple, and some of you here will know who I'm talking about, who had a rough time in marriage, and the husband took these head of the house passages to mean that he was the master of his slave. He treated her like dirt. Well, one night there was a preacher who was holding a gospel meeting in town. He was coming over to their house for dinner. Well, the preacher had met this family before, known them a great deal, but for some reason he couldn't think of the lady's name. So he figured, when I get there, I'll just wait and see when the husband asks her for something. I'll figure out her name and I'll come back and I'll look fine. We preachers were always figuring out ways to remember people's names. He figured that would work. But it didn't. He came back to the services that night and told someone about the problem he'd been having. He said, "I never did find out her name because all her husband called her all night was woman. Woman, pass me the butter. Woman, get this. Woman, get me some more milk." That's probably needless to say that couple was no longer together. Submission is not popular because of such abuses by men. Submission is not popular because some people in our world are purporting that it simply is a prelude to domestic abuse. In those weddings that I've done, I still put the words love, honor, and obey your husband. Someone after this last wedding I did asked me, "Where'd you get that word obey? I thought we took that out years ago. Where'd you get that?" I said, "I think it was the Apostle Paul in Titus chapter 2. And although that word is there, no, it's not a prelude to domestic abuse, because if wives are following what they should follow from God, and if, it's a big if sometimes, but if husbands are following the instructions they have from God, then they should love their wives as Christ loved the church. He died for it. He gave himself for it. He didn't beat it into submission. And they should love their wives as they love their own bodies. For no one ever hated his flesh, Ephesians 5:29. You don't see many husbands going around beating themselves. So submission is not inferiority, and even though it's not popular, it's still the godly way to greatness. Did you realize that? Jesus was teaching over and over again to his disciples who were struggling for power. If you want to be first, be servant of all. And submission is really a blessed position. You know that there are jobs that I would not want to have because I would have to give orders that I would not feel comfortable giving. There are a whole lot of times in my life that I would much rather be in submission to someone who is making those decisions. There's times I wouldn't, but there's times that I would. When you are in a position of responsibility, you carry the responsibility when the decision-making goes awry. As modern lingo says, it's on your head. If it messes up, it's on your head because you made the decision. And husbands, when you make a decision for your home to move them to Omaha or some other flat place in the country, and it goes wrong, then you bear the responsibility for it. Sometimes being in submission can be a really blessed thing. Submission is following the example of Sarah. Turn with me, if you will, to 1 Peter chapter 3 again. In 1 Peter chapter 3, this discussion of wives ends up, in verse 6, saying that wives ought to be submissive to their husbands as Sarah was to Abraham. As Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. Now let's just think for a minute about times that Sarah might have submitted to Abraham. Some of these we don't have recorded in the scriptures, so I submit to you them as only surmisings. But think about the things that they went through in the accounts that we have and what her position must have been. Abram, before he's Abraham, says to Sarai, before she's Sarah, come on, we're going. We're moving. Now, as Denver pointed out there, I'm getting old pretty quick. My wife and I, we moved 5 times in 8 years at one point, which means I can't hold a job, I guess. It could be more true than I realize. But now, moving is not a pleasant thing, and Marcia has said she's not moving for a while now, and I want to respect that. But Abram tells Sarah, we're leaving. And the first question would be, don't you think, where are we going? And Abram would say, I don't know. Wherever God shows us. But she submitted to him. And then one day, after she's had a child at the age of 90 that's been promised for about 25 years, he gets a little bit older. The boy and his father get up early one morning. Maybe she rolls over in bed and says, where are you going? Oh, we're going to sacrifice Isaac. Just lay that down. Now, you don't know that happened. You don't know exactly how things went. Granted. But can you see some husbands trying to take their sons to do what God has said in such a drastic way when their wives don't show any submission at all? Sarah submitted to Abraham. Now, on the other side of the coin, I know I'm not here to preach about husbands, but husbands ought to allow their wives some leeway. Abraham allowed Sarah some leeway, didn't he? When Hagar conceived and Sarah couldn't, Hagar started scoffing Sarah. Sarah complained to Abraham. Abraham said, do with her what you want. Left that decision in her hands. Or in chapter 21, when Hagar's son started making fun of Isaac's son, Sarah said to Abraham, he's not going to be heir together with my son Isaac. And although it hurt him, although it pained him, one scripture indicates in Genesis 21, Abraham took that boy and his mother and set them out from their household. At God's instructions. But Sarah submitted to Abraham, sometimes for the bad, when he convinced her to lie for him in Egypt and Gerar. But she was submissive, is the point here. And that's how wives are to be to their husbands. Thirdly, wives ought to be faithful in their roles of instruction Titus chapter 2, as we've mentioned, instructs that the older women should teach the younger women. Do you know what the older women should teach the younger women to do? Well, here's one thing. Love their husbands, verse 4. Older women should teach younger women to love their husbands. Now, someone will say, how can you teach someone to love their husbands? You just fall in love, don't you? Well, that's the popular assessment of the word love. But the word love in the Bible, of course, means that unconditional caring that you purposely do for someone. Sometimes people have said to me, I just don't have feelings for my spouse anymore, indicating with their tone of voice that I'd like to end this marriage. I just don't have feelings for my spouse. I don't love them like I used to. I want to say to them, who cares? You're still supposed to love them. You promised to stay with them till death do you part. That passage teaches us that love is something that can be taught, and therefore it's something that can be practiced by wives, however young or old, even in bad times. Wives are supposed to teach all those around them by their examples as well. The first two verses of 1 Peter chapter 3 indicate for us that wives who have non-Christian husbands are supposed to stay with them and try to convert them, not by preaching at them every Sunday when they are sitting in the couch and not going to church, but by their example. Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Have you ever thought about the example of Abigail in the Old Testament? In 1 Samuel 25, I'm sure you have. But here is a lady who is married to a scoundrel. That's what his name means, a scoundrel. It might be translated son of Belial. His name was Nabal. David, you see, had been having his men guard Nabal's men while they were tending their sheep. Now, in return for that, David, being on the run from Saul, who wanted to kill him, would like some food for his men. But Nabal says, no, I'm not giving you any food. I'm saving it for my men. David then begins to take vengeance into his own hands and determines that he will kill every male in the household of Nabal by morning. Abigail, Nabal's wife, gets word of this and prepares a whole lot of food and brings it out to David and says, look, you don't have any right to do this. It's not your position to take vengeance upon people. Here is a woman who defended her husband even when he didn't deserve it. Now, there are cases if a husband is slapping around his wife that I don't think that kind of treatment is deserved. But there are some cases that I see where wives or husbands want out on pretty slim excuses. Abigail did not take matters into her own hands. She left them in God's. A few days after all this incident, Nabal was dead and she became David's wife. And she thanked God for taking care of it for her. Wives ought to be godly in their instruction to each other and to those around them, to their husbands, to their children. That's one reason that Paul said for unbelieving spouses, for spouses to stay with their unbelieving spouses. You know, in 1 Corinthians 7, the question came up whether people who were Christians could really stay with a heathen spouse, one who hadn't become a Christian. And Paul's answer was, yes, stay with them, because your children will be sanctified and your husband will be sanctified. He didn't mean that they were automatically saved. He just meant, I think, that they had a better chance of being saved because the godly instruction would still be in the home. I wish I could have you talk with every wife, some probably here, who have had to put up with an ungodly husband all of their lives, but did so faithfully, and thereby led so many other people to Christ without ever saying a word. Godly wives will solidify the home. And I could read you a lot of statistics to back that up. Statistics like how 53% of the people in prison came from homes that weren't the traditional mother-father home, when only like 20-some percent of society comes from homes like that. That was a few years ago, but you see the discrepancy. Wives who do their best to stick things out, whatever the case may be, find themselves in the position of a worthy woman that is hard to find. The Proverbs had a lot to say about wives. some of them I think should be inscribed on the walls of some houses. You know, in some houses you have hanging on the refrigerator something like Joshua 24:15. Choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I think in some houses you ought to inscribe on the refrigerator Proverbs 21:9. Better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman. You ever seen women like that? You don't know of them. Maybe you do know of them, but you're not them. On the other hand, the Proverbs say that he who finds a wife finds a good thing. Chapter 18:22. And they say that an excellent wife is the crown of her husband, but she who causes shame is like rottenness in his bones. And they say in chapter 19:14, houses and riches are an inheritance from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. And these proverbs say in Proverbs 31:10, who can find a virtuous wife, for her worth is far above rubies? The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it. From her profits, she plants a vineyard. You see, she doesn't keep any of her profits to herself. She uses them for the betterment of her family. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good and her lamp does not go out by night. She's not a lazy person. She stretches out her hands to the distaff and her hand holds the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is well known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes him. She doesn't break him. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies sashes for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Now here's the point. Charm is deceitful, and beauty is passing. But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. In the lecture, I wrote of a lady who was dying with cancer. She was one of the best examples to me I've ever seen of a godly wife. And you've never seen anything like this if you didn't experience this. Her hospital room would have made the nurses upset if it were anybody else, because there were at least 12 people in there all the time. But a lot of them were nurses that she had come to know through her volunteer work at the hospital, which she did because she wanted to repay for the goodness that was shown to her when her mother and sister died of cancer. Her family was close, her family was tight, and they're still faithful. This one lady, affected so many people in the community of Parkersburg and the surrounding area that if you tried to list them, you couldn't. And she passed from this life on October 3rd. There were almost 500 people at her funeral. And at that funeral, two people from the funeral home, from the funeral home staff, said they would like to worship at Camden Avenue after seeing the funeral that we had in the church building there for her. One friend of the family said that she was definitely going to start worshiping at Camden Avenue and has been there every Sunday since. And so you were reminded of Revelation 14:13, which says, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord. that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. Right now in your mind, you could name 10, 20, maybe 100 ladies from decades that I never saw and that a lot of people here never saw, whose influence is still felt in the godliness of people around you. Godly wives, may we say that we love you and we appreciate you.
I'd like to remind